The Ohio River is one of the most polluted in the nation, but something new showed up last summer.
It started looking kind of like a neon slime across the top of the river. It was kind of eerie in a way.
I'm Kara Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, toxic algae blooms are the stuff of nightmares when it comes to drinking water and river recreation. That story as our Headwater series about the Ohio continues. Plus, we're adding up the carbon footprint of a typical Thanksgiving meal.
You probably can't have lower carbon footprint food than potatoes and pumpkins.
Shop accordingly. And how to talk about contentious issues like climate change while you're talking turkey with family and friends. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Under President-elect Donald Trump, Pennsylvania's natural gas industry could see higher production, fewer environmental restrictions, and more pipelines to take its products to market. Its struggling coal industry might also get more help. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports on what Trump's presidency could mean for the Commonwealth's energy sector.
Trump's win was a big surprise to everyone, including people in the oil and gas industry. In fact, they gave more money to Hillary Clinton's campaign, according to an analysis by the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. But this election is a good surprise, says Matt Henderson, a consultant who works with drilling companies.
You know, Pennsylvania's success is really dependent upon the national success out there.
Trump has pledged to reduce the size of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and roll back regulations.
And having, you know, again, the Trump administration in there putting more of a business-minded approach out there, looking at weighing everything equally, will help Pennsylvania's economy to continue to grow, especially in the oil and gas sector.
Under Trump, Henderson says the federal government is expected to become a lot friendlier to fossil fuels.
I think the biggest difference we're going to see is, you know, these federal agencies now are going to realize that really they work for the people and it's not the other way around.
But the states still get a say in what happens. For example, earlier this year, New York State, which has a Democratic governor and banned fracking within its borders, denied necessary permits to a major gas transmission pipeline planned to move Marcellus shale gas to New England. And more recently, a new gas liquids pipeline was delayed in the Commonwealth. The company cited problems getting permits from Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection. Henderson says it will still be good to have an industry cheerleader in the White House.
I think that pressure that coming down from the federal government will help move those projects along and take out the politics again and make it more of a maybe a business decision versus how it's been done in the past.
Trump will get to make new appointments to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is charged with oversight of interstate gas pipelines. He's also pledged to cancel the Paris Climate Accord, revive the coal industry, and open up more federal land to oil and gas drilling. For the environmental community, his win is a major blow.
Pennsylvania has been in a really difficult position relative to oil and gas even before the election.
Joanne Kilgour heads the state chapter of the Sierra Club.
We saw just this past year what a difficult fight it was to secure even baseline common sense regulations for the unconventional oil and gas industry.
She expects many of the same fights to continue in Harrisburg over drilling regulations and permitting for new gas pipelines.
And one positive outcome is that we've seen a lot of new energy from people on the ground who are joining organizations, donating to organizations, asking how they can get involved, and are really re-energized to help further the fight for the health and safety of our communities.
Governor Tom Wolf, a Democrat, says his administration is still committed to combating climate change. The state is in the midst of creating new rules for greenhouse gas emissions at oil and gas sites. And most states, including Pennsylvania, already have renewable energy standards. Those are targets for producing a certain amount of electricity from cleaner sources. That's good news to people like Rob Jackson, a researcher at Stanford University, who says Trump can't single-handedly undo the forces propelling cleaner energy.
He can't derail renewables completely, and I'm not sure he wants to. The costs for wind and solar are plummeting, and market forces are too strong. My source of optimism comes primarily from the states and cities and local actions that are happening.
On the campaign trail, Trump promised to bring back coal while at the same time promoting robust natural gas development. His message clearly resonated in Pennsylvania, which has lost roughly 3,000 coal jobs in the past 4 years. Gas drilling has also slowed significantly amid low commodity prices. But the rhetoric of promoting both coal and gas doesn't align with reality, says Emily Hammond, a law professor at George Washington University.
Truly, those two resources are competing right now for that presence in the electric market. And so the idea of having both of those come to the forefront is hard to square with those market forces.
It remains to be seen what campaign promises Trump will be able to follow through with. Just before the election results were in, federal analysts predicted the coming year will mirror current trends, with a decline in coal, expanded use of natural gas, and a growing footprint for renewable energy. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The conflicts between the natural gas industry and environmentalists over what President-elect Trump might do could mirror other disagreements closer to home, like at the Thanksgiving table this year. Tensions are already running high, and we know talking about politics or environmental issues like climate change with family and friends at the holidays is supposed to be a no-no. Psychologist Mary Beth Manarino says the topic bumps up against feelings about what kind of life we're living and if we're being judged for it. Manarino teaches about psychology and the environment at Chatham University in Pittsburgh. I visited her on campus and asked her how she learned to talk with students of different backgrounds about things like climate change and how we can do the same this Thanksgiving.
We do a lot of exercises in class, one of them being going to different points in the room based on how important your faith or your politics are to you. Not the content of them, but how important they are. And what we find is that you can have someone who is very adamantly liberal, left-wing, in the same corner as someone who's very conservative, right-wing. And so they visually see that, wow, this is really important to this other person, just as it is to me.
So how do you start talking about how to talk about it and be in the same room together?
Yeah, so once we notice that people who know each other but maybe haven't talked about these things before have strong feelings that are different than yours, you already like them as a person, and so we talk about being curious with each other about where those beliefs come from. And these are people in training to be psychologists and counselors, so they already are pretty good at empathic listening and respect.
Most people aren't psychologists. And then, so, you know, at the holidays, we're often with people who we do know, and we may have different values than they have. You're at the table, people are talking about something, and maybe someone brings up the weather, and that make someone else think about climate change, and your cousin Larry says, well, I just think this climate change thing is a hoax. You may have a different opinion about that. So, I mean, I guess you could just say nothing. But if you wanted to talk about it, say something, what would be a first step to doing that?
Thanksgiving is a time when you're supposed to kind of gather together and get along. I wouldn't recommend doing something that's going to be very disruptive, but I also think that it's fair that each person should be able to express their opinions about something. What we find when we talk about climate change and other environmental issues is if you reach out and ask the other person about their beliefs and what do they know about climate change, and show a genuine interest in it and why they feel so strongly about it. And then you're meeting them where they are, and then you can say something like, I've done a lot of thinking about this as well because it's potentially very upsetting. And here are some things that I've done to educate myself about it. So that's one of the things, is to meet them where they are and then kind of express yourself in a way that respects that they may be different.
What if it gets heated?
What if it gets heated? I think my recommendation is always to take the high road and to say that it is potentially a volatile topic, and that you'd be happy to talk about it another time if somebody really wants to sit down and hammer out some of the differences that you have about it. What we know from research about this is that nobody changes their mind in response to preaching or even just giving factual information. It's more, we're in this together and let's get to know each other and let's kind of talk about this.
I'll just say I have been in this situation before and it's uncomfortable. And I think that the discomfort is what makes us say things or do things that maybe we regret later, or maybe we're not that, they don't really get us very far. And so how do we get comfortable with that discomfort? Because you have to kind of get past that in order to have a conversation about it.
I think discomfort is a part of conversation and dialogue that's in person that we've gotten away from because so much of our communication is technologically driven, where you put something out there and you don't have to deal with the person in front of you. And so we haven't learned to deal with talking with someone whose ideas make you feel uncomfortable, because you can put it out there and then walk away. So I would embrace the discomfort and see it as a sign that you're taking a brave step in talking about this. You're having courage in talking about it. Take a deep breath. And again, put yourself in the position of almost an anthropologist or an explorer to try to understand the other person's perspective, because that will make it more likely that they'll respond to you in kind and you'll be able to have an honest conversation about it.
Mary Beth Manarino teaches in the psychology department at Chatham University in Pittsburgh. For more tips on talking about climate change and the environment, go to AlleghenyFront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Google Street View cars cruise around cities, photographing roads and buildings so people can figure out how to get from point A to point B. But some of these vehicles have a secret weapon in the trunk.
That's where the sensor is.
It's a methane detector, and in a handful of cities, it's helping plug up underground gas leaks contributing to climate change. We're rolling up to that story later on the Allegheny Front. Stay tuned. So now you might be prepping for how to talk with family about your deepest feelings on climate change. But how much of it are you causing just by traveling home and eating that holiday turkey? Producer Lou Bluen set out to calculate the carbon footprint of a typical Thanksgiving experience. Like, does it make a difference if you buy a turkey locally? Is it better to fly home or drive solo in a car? Here's what he found out.
Turns out the guy who may know the most about the carbon footprint of an American Thanksgiving hasn't ever experienced one himself.
I haven't actually, although it doesn't look all that dissimilar from our Christmas dinner in the UK.
This is Mike Berners-Lee, and he's considered one of the world's leading experts on the carbon footprint of, well, everything. In fact, he wrote a book subtitled The Carbon Footprint of Everything. So earlier this week, I phoned him at his office in the UK to talk a little turkey.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, turkeys are meat. And most of the time, the thing to say about meats is that they're quite an inefficient way of having nutrition. But having said that, chicken and turkeys are very much at the efficient end of the meat spectrum.
That's because a Thanksgiving turkey can go from an egg to a bird that's 20 pounds or more in just 14 weeks. So they're not really on the planet long enough to make that big an impact. And it turns out it doesn't even matter all that much if you go with a local bird, which only has to ship from the farmer down the road.
Well, it matters a bit, but it would still be fairly small compared to the actual footprint of growing the animal in the first place.
In fact, Berners-Lee says transportation might only account for about 25% of the turkey's total carbon footprint, assuming it's not shipping by air. But bottom line, having a turkey on your Thanksgiving table is not all that bad. And the same goes for corn, potatoes, cranberries, pumpkins, and a lot of the other foods that end up on your plate.
So they're seasonal vegetables, and they keep well. And you don't have to do anything crazy like put them on an aeroplane. So they're fantastic. In fact, you probably can't have lower carbon footprint food than potatoes and pumpkins.
So all in all, the Thanksgiving dinner looks pretty good from a carbon footprint standpoint. That is, if you go traditional.
Yeah, so okay, well, this year's a little bit different, a little bit of a curveball. But there is no turkey.
This is WESA reporter Margaret Krause. She agreed to let us dissect the carbon footprint of her Thanksgiving plans, which are still kind of coming together.
There is a meat that will be grilled outside. Maybe we're doing bratwurst. Maybe we're doing chicken. Maybe we're doing steak.
Whatever she decides to cook, it sounds like it's going to be a bit of a fire drill. The plan is to get on a plane and on Wednesday night hit the supermarket to pick up some supplies when she lands.
So check this. I'm getting on a bus that will take me to the airport, that will take me to Minneapolis, that will take me to Salt Lake City, and then driving from Salt Lake City to Provo, Utah.
So all in all, a pretty big trip. And that, along with the alternative menu, could get Margaret into some trouble, according to Mike Berners-Lee.
Well, yeah, red meats are quite a lot less efficient. The carbon footprint of beef would be about 24 kilos of carbon dioxide equivalent per kilo of beef, whereas for turkey, it'd be nearer 3.
And the air travel is a real killer.
So a Boeing 747 will get through, I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but it's 100 and something tons of fuel per trip. So you end up with an enormous carbon footprint shared out between the passengers, and your friend has to take a few tons of it on the chin.
Even worse, Berners-Lee says the fact that the fuel is burning higher up in the atmosphere doubles the climate impacts. So drive if you can, better yet, take a train. But how does the carbon footprint of Thanksgiving travel stack up against the Thanksgiving meal? Well, Berners-Lee did a quick calculation on my 500-mile trip back to Michigan by car.
So you're getting through about 50 liters of gas. So that would be the same carbon footprint as turning up and finding your way through 50 kilos of turkey, which would be quite an achievement.
Yeah, no way that's happening, even with leftovers. And at my house, my mom has a pretty energy-efficient way for storing those. When the fridge fills up, as long as the Michigan fall weather is cooperating, she puts the turkey in her car to keep it cold. Pretty sure that method is keeping the planet safe from harm. Not sure I can say the same for us. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lou Bluin.
And if football is part of your Thanksgiving tradition, Lou looked into the carbon load of that, too. The answer and calculations on the carbon footprints of some other traditional Thanksgiving foods, I'm really pulling for cranberry sauce, that's at our website, AlleghenyFront.org.
Feel fine today, walking on cloud nine today. I'm over that line today. Happiness is finally mine today. I guess I'm just a lucky guy, and here I'm about to tell you why. It's strictly on account of my sweet potato pie.
A toxic algae bloom that stretched hundreds of miles along the Ohio River last summer stunned many people living there. But not everyone. As Carol Lofton reports for the Allegheny Front, experts are warning that with climate change and unregulated farm runoff, the green slime will no doubt be back.
Ethan Wells has lived along the Ohio River for almost all of his 32 years. One day last August, he noticed blue-green algae growing along the riverbank near his home in Sistersville, an hour south of Wheeling, West Virginia.
I grew up on a farm around ponds and on the river, so I knew what it was.
Each time he looked, there was more of it.
As it progressed and it started to cover the river, it started looking kind of like a neon slime across the top of the river, and it was kind of eerie in a way to have the river alive like that.
A lot of people noticed.
The first time the Great Ohio River Swim is now canceled, all because of a problem with algae in our river.
Yeah, there's an advisory against recreational activities in the river.
That summer, more than 600 miles of toxic algae, known as cyanobacteria, was reported in West Virginia, Ohio, and all the way downriver in Illinois. Touching the stuff can be dangerous, causing rashes, lung, and kidney problems. Previous algae blooms around the world have been deadly. So states issued health warnings to avoid contact with a thick, stinky slime. This This is the sound of the West Virginia American Water Treatment Plant in Huntington, one of 14 drinking water plants that found blooms in their intakes during last summer's outbreak. Laura Martin is a spokesperson for the company.
At a certain point, we actually enacted our contingency plan for the Huntington water system to switch over to an alternate source.
Since then, Martin says developing ways to deal with toxic algae is the plant's number one priority. During the 2015 bloom, water plants used chemicals to ensure the water was safe to send to customers. But
it's expensive.
That's Stanley States, who was water quality manager at the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority for decades. He's now an instructor at Texas A&M University and travels around the country teaching water utilities how to deal with disasters like cyanobacteria. He's not kidding about the cost. The water plant in Huntington spent $700,000 to deal with one outbreak on the Ohio. But without statewide or even regional regulations, all the plants can do is figure out ways to filter and treat the stuff.
The ultimate solution to controlling cyanobacterial blooms is going to be control of the release of excess nutrients into bodies of water.
Nutrients, especially phosphates, have been blamed for algae blooms in rivers and lakes all over the world. Phosphorus comes from sewage plants, lawns, and particularly agriculture. There are some 250,000 farms in the Ohio River watershed.
So if on farmland they use artificial fertilizers, they're supplemented with phosphates. If a farmer uses natural fertilizers, dung, that's loaded with phosphates. So rains wash these phosphates into rivers, to lakes.
When that phosphorus mixes with warm summer water, which is getting warmer as the climate changes, the combination creates the perfect recipe for cyanobacteria to bloom. On Lake Erie, toxic blooms have become something of a late summer ritual. The bloom in 2014 was so big that nearly 500,000 people lost their drinking water in Toledo, Ohio. Stanley State says the Ohio River could also continue to have blooms, in part because of all the locks and dams along the river that regulate flow.
It's not a free-flowing river. It's a series of lakes.
When the blooms took off on the Ohio River last summer, the state of Ohio was quick to respond.
A lot of what we were doing on the Ohio River, we learned from our situation up in Toledo.
Carl Gebhardt is Deputy Director of Water Resources with the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency.
That we wanted to make sure that since they had never experienced this before, we were very quick in getting to them to make sure that they were sampling the water before it came into the intake and were implementing the proper treatment.
Ohio has become a key state to watch when it comes to treating toxic blooms. Farm runoff, in general, has been largely unregulated. But last year, in an effort to reduce nutrient runoff, Ohio passed a law limiting when farmers can apply manure to farm fields.
That was a big legislative achievement that the ag community to their credit bought into.
Ohio isn't going it alone. It's working with other states around the Great Lakes to reduce nutrient runoff. Their collaborative goal? Cut this type of pollution 40% over the next decade. Gebhardt says Ohio's new runoff regulations apply to farms all over the state, so it's also expected to keep pollution out of the Ohio River. So far, other river states haven't taken these kinds of steps, though.
Hopefully, West Virginia, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Indiana would look at that and say, okay, do we feel confident in our program that, you know, we're doing what we can do, or do we need to revisit that?
Gebhardt says state coordination could reduce pollution and prevent more toxic algae all along the river. And in the long run, that could save water treatment plants money and help ensure safe drinking water for the 5 million people who depend on the Ohio.
That was Carol Lofton of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, our partners in the Headwater series, Exploring the Ohio River. More of those stories are at AlleghenyFront.org/Headwaters. So this week, I got into the backseat of a car with a stranger.
It's a little snug.
My name is Karen Tuxen-Bettman, and I manage the Google Earth Outreach Program.
Tuxin Bettman and I were squished together in a specially outfitted Google Street View car so she could show me how the hatchback does double duty. You've seen the Google fleet riding up and down streets, cameras mounted on top, so users get a 360-degree view of roads and neighborhoods. This is one of four cars that's also mapping methane leaks from gas pipelines underneath streets in 11 cities across the country.
As we're driving along, we will be picking up methane concentrations from different sources.
Our driver tools around the morning rush in downtown Pittsburgh, just minding his own business, looking out for traffic. But a clear tube under the front bumper of the car is taking in air. It runs inside, along the door, and into the trunk.
That's where the sensor is, or the analyzer.
The noisy silver box detects methane, the main ingredient in natural gas, and a major contributor to global warming. It also picks up on the ethane in gas. That's how the algorithm determines the methane is coming from the city's old natural gas infrastructure. Tuxin Bettman leans forward and reads a monitor mounted in the front seat.
Let's see. So, in the last couple of minutes, it looks like we did pass some emissions of methane, but I don't see a corresponding ethane leak. So it's possible that that could have been emissions from a sewer manhole.
Google is partnering with the Environmental Defense Fund and People's Gas on this project to see where and how much methane is escaping in Pittsburgh.
Pennsylvania is an important place to do this because it has the largest amount of leak-prone pipe of any state in the country.
That's Steve Hamburg, chief scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund. He spoke earlier at a briefing about the initial pilot project in Pittsburgh. It covered three neighborhoods, including downtown, and they found 200 leaks, most small, a few big, in a little over 300 miles of pipes. It turns out almost half of the gas lines in the city are more than 50 years old. People's Gas is already working on replacing these dinosaurs. In the past, they've classified which pipes they should yank out first based on a lot of factors, including safety, and rightly so. But Ed Palumbo, vice president of reliability at People's, says the amount of methane leaking from pipes wasn't really part of the equation. They didn't have the technology.
We're able to take this additional data point and bring it into our own risk rankings that our engineering group does to help schedule and prioritize those pipeline replacements over the next 20 years.
He says the utility's goal is to quickly become more like Indianapolis, where leaks are few and far between. It's better for their bottom line and for customers' bills. Palumbo says if it helps with climate change, so much the better. People's actually contacted the Environmental Defense Fund to get this project rolling in Pittsburgh. And what's in it for Google? Well, back inside the Street View car, Karen Tuxin Bettman says Google likes to try new things.
And this is something that I think everybody cares about, environmental air quality and climate change. We think that if we can help with a technology piece and partner with organizations that can make an impact on the ground, that it's a win-win for everybody.
The project is expanded into more Pittsburgh neighborhoods with the help of Carnegie Mellon University. Tuxin Bettman says they're also looking into whether more of Google's cars can carry this expensive, high-grade scientific equipment, and if someday they can map other invisible pollutants in the air, like ozone and fine particulate matter. There's more, including maps of those methane leaks in Pittsburgh and other cities, at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to the show this week. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.